Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate.
Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm your host, Amanda Bullock. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. It's April. April is National Poetry Month, and we're celebrating with a collection of some of our favorite poetry moments over the years at Literary Arts. We'll hear from a Portland high school student, from the United States Poet Laureate, from an Oregon Literary Fellowship recipient, from a Nobel Prize winner, and more. To begin, here's Ada Limon, U.S. Poet Laureate, from her Portland Arts and Lectures event in April 2023. She talks about how important reading poetry has been to her in connecting to herself and to the natural world, and how she came to poetry as a young girl.
A complicated love on poetry and nature. As you might expect, in this public role that I have as the Poet Laureate of the United States, I advocate for poetry. I advocate for how it humanizes us and complicates us and makes room for mystery and wonder and unease. I love poetry, so advocating for poetry isn't hard for me. I believe in it. I believe we will all be made better by reading it and writing it. The argument for it is, to be banal, easy. Yeah, read poetry. And you will feel as if the doors of the world are opening. And still, there are times when advocating for poetry is difficult. Sure, because we also need so many things. When I say need, I don't mean desire, but deeply need. Housing, shelter, healthcare, safety, equity, justice, peace, all the things we need. And here I am saying, you should read a line or two of poetry. It can feel a bit naive, to say the least, even a bit unhinged. But tonight, I want to suggest that it's not naive to believe in poetry's power. Poetry works in tandem with all the other necessities. The urgent issue that is at the forefront and is interconnected to everything is, of course, the planet itself. I want to make a case for reading and writing poetry as a way to reconnect to the natural world. Not everyone has the same relationship with poetry that I do. I recognize that. I've been writing poetry and reading poetry for over 30 years now. And not everyone has the relationship I have with nature either. I am from Sonoma, California, and I grew up in a place where nature was in everything that we did. Everywhere around us was nature and wilderness. The hills that were around the high school track, the oak trees by my elementary school, the vineyards even, all that was alive and interwoven into the days. Meanwhile, I have a good friend who was raised in Louisville, Kentucky, who said, I never liked nature because the woods were where bad things happened. If you were to find a body, you'd find that body in the woods. And there is no denying that when someone asked her to write about nature, she wasn't all too peaceful about it. And I have friends that grew up in urban settings so that even a potted plant in front of a deli was as rare of a find as a sense of reciprocity with what we might call wilderness. And yet, we too are nature. As human animals, we are, whether we know it or not, or whether we like it or not, in relationship to non-human animals. And not unlike being in relationship with one another, that can give us a sense of wholeness, of belonging, or even of community. Am I saying that one must read or write poetry about a tree in order to love a tree or connect to that tree? No, but I am saying that it can help, and that that sense of connection can help us feel less alone, less separate and isolated from the world. Something every study, podcast, and article is saying we need right now, a sense of wholeness. I remember finding the book Water Babies by Charles Kingsley. And to be honest, I don't remember that book at all. But I do remember the poem that served as the epigraph. I didn't know what an epigraph was, and I didn't know it was an excerpt from a poem. I thought it was the whole poem. But none of that stopped me from knowing that I loved it, and that it mirrored exactly how I felt when I was hiding in my trees, being alone in the understory, away from the cruelty of other children or the chaos of the classroom. The poem's excerpt went like this. I heard 1,000 blended notes while in a grove I sat reclined, in that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to mind. To her fair works did nature link the human soul that through me ran, and much it grieved my heart to think what man has made of man. It wasn't until much later in college that I found out that the poem was written by Wordsworth, and that it was written in April of 1798, or that the title was Lines Written in Early Spring. I only knew that it was my favorite part of that book, the part that was written not in sentences, but in lines, and that I loved how it rhymed, yes, like a little song. But more than all of that, I loved that it gave language to a feeling that I could not speak of or didn't know how to speak to in any coherent way. It was the feeling that even being in a beautiful place, one can feel sad or lonely, or not even lonely, but empty or worried. That was all in the line, in that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to the mind. I thought, yes, I have been sad. I am sad right now, though I don't know how to explain it. And then, of course, the poem moves to say, if we are nature and I am linked to nature, why does the human being, the human animal, do what it does? Why has it caused such harm? That's how I read the lines, to her fair works did nature link the human soul that through me ran, and much to grieve my heart to think what man is made of man. I understood that grief, the way I watch kids be unkind to each other. Julian and Tucker and Jesus, who were all kind when they were in kindergarten, and then as they aged, they grew up cruel to each other, and they all seemed like they were suffering for no reason. When the birds in the trees didn't seem to be suffering or in pain. Of course, these were childhood thoughts before I knew the agonies of history and war, slavery and genocide, the climate crisis. But still, what man has made of man made sense to me. And even as a child, I grieved for it too. The question at its core was, if nature can provide this ease, and we are a part of nature, where did we all go wrong? I never studied this poem formally, or even knew it was something to be studied. I just found it in a book and carried it around with me and never really read the rest of the book. I would stand by the floor heater in the dark hallway before anyone was home, and I'd try to memorize it. I was always cold back then. I don't know why. But I'd sit almost on top of the heater and practice these words. I knew it was a poem, but mainly I knew it made me feel less alone. The great thinker and writer James Baldwin once said, "You think your pain and heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read." It was books that taught me that the things that tormented me most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive, who had ever been alive. And that's what that poem did to me. Even then, a little brown girl in California understood what a white man in England who had died over 150 years ago was saying, and I felt it too. Poetry, all these years later, has said to me, yes, me too, I have seen that too, I feel that too. And there's an immense power in that. Maybe there's a little hope too. Because in feeling seen or understood, there's a sense that we can be in community with others, that one won't go mad with isolation or otherness. That experience with the poem by Wordsworth gave me a sense of belonging. I thought, if other people could write and feel this way, if other people could feel connected to the world, then maybe I could be okay. Maybe I belonged here on this planet after all, in this world.
That was Ada Limón, U.S. Poet Laureate, talking about discovering and loving a Wordsworth poem and how she connected to the poem across time and space. That connection continues to our next poet, Nobel Laureate Seamus Heaney, who shared one of his early poems and the story behind it at Portland Arts and Lectures 2 decades before Ada Limón in 2002.
I want to read some poems from my first book, written at that time in the 1960s, and some more recent ones, so it'll be poems from all periods. I was lecturing in English, as I say, and I have to thank English teachers throughout my career since I was a schoolboy for leading towards poetry. One of the poets I studied at sixth form, and who has stayed with me, and to whom I think any poet will return for confirmation about the nature of the calling and instruction about it, is William Wordsworth. And there is a little section in Wordsworth's autobiography, his poem, The Prelude, which he calls The Growth of a Poet's Mind. There are 4 or 5 lines that suited my own experience so well that if I ever wrote an autobiography, which I don't expect I will, I could put these lines on the as an epigraph. Wordsworth's talking about his transferal from early life in Hawkshead and then a removal to another part of the Lake District later on. And he says, fair seed time had my soul, and I grew up fostered alike by beauty and by fear. Much favored in my birthplace, and no less in that beloved vale to which ere long I was transplanted. I think transplanting is probably a little bit of exile, a little bit of displacement is probably important in the lives of creative people. A little bit of exile from the first place is a great help. Beauty and fear. And I thought I would begin with a poem, one of the first poems I wrote. It is about being scared. It's a kind of Wordsworthian type poem. I wasn't thinking of Wordsworth when I wrote it. Like all young poets, I was thinking of myself. And it's called Death of a Naturalist. It was described once in the Irish Times, when it appeared in a little pamphlet, as a long, disappointing poem about frogs. But I've always maintained that it is not long at all. It's quite short. Anyway, there's a reference to the flax stand. This was about kind of, it tells the story of kind of childhood encounter with a scaresome aspect of the world around one, the frogs. In a flax dam, a place where the flax crop was buried in water and laid, allowed to ret, the technical term, to keep it underwater until it began to stink and reek, and then it was taken out and went on to other processes. Death of a Naturalist. All year the flax dam festered in the heart of the townland. Green and heavy-headed, flax had rotted there, weighted down by huge sods. Daily it sweltered in the punishing sun. Bubbles gargled delicately. Blue bottles wove a strong gauze of sound around the smell. There were dragonflies, spotted butterflies. But best of all was the warm, thick slobber of frog spawn that grew like clotted water in the shade of the banks. Here, every spring, I would fill jampotfuls of the jellied specks to range on windowsills at home, on shelves at school, and wait and watch until the fattening dots burst into nimble swimming tadpoles. Miss Walls would tell us how the daddy frog was called a bullfrog and how he croaked, and how the mammy frog laid hundreds of little eggs, and this was frog spawn. You could tell the weather by frogs too, for they were yellow in the sun and brown in rain. Then, one hot day when fields were rank with cow dung in the grass, the angry frogs invaded the flax dam. I ducked through hedges to a coarse croaking that I hadn't heard before. The air was thick with a bass chorus. Right down the dam, gross-bellied frogs were cocked on sods. Their loose necks pulsed like sails. Some hopped. The slap and plop were obscene threats. Some sat poised like mud grenades, their blunt heads farting. I sickened, turned, and ran. The great slime kings were gathered there for vengeance, and I knew that if I dipped my hand, the spawn would clutch it. Thank you very much.
We have a full episode of that event with Seamus Heaney, which is one of my favorite episodes. Treat yourself and check it out. Similar to the way Heaney was responding to Wordsworth, our next poet directly engages with a Mary Oliver poem. This is Donica Leong, who was a senior at Lincoln High School at the time, at Verslandia 2022.
Miss Mary Oliver, I gotta know, your poem, Wild Geese, when you wrote it, did you know that I'd forever quote it, keep it like a quota, hold it, and never let go of it? Because that opening line, you do not have to be good. I'll confess that I've stressed and obsessed incessantly what the meaning of this line could profess. You see, Miss Oliver, I have strived all my life to be good. My name is synonymous with front row dweller, go-to English word speller, P-E-R-F-E-C-T, because that is what people tell her to be. I have spent summers in classrooms, winter breaks in book rooms, Sundays and Saturdays until my grades look like AAA batteries, all until I am undeniably, unequivocally understood as good. Here's the thing though, Miss Oliver. Did you know that what lies at the precipice of success is not a gold throne, but a tight rope, a slight slope that hangs over the pause between how are you and the response? And even if the words, I'm good, roll more naturally off the tongue than a breath, there is still yet a moment to consider. Miss Oliver, last weekend I had a panic attack in the back of a coffee shop. Acrid espresso and brown sugar the backdrop for heaving unsteady breaths, my hands clenched across my chest, one shaky gasp in, choke, whimper out all that I have left. Miss Oliver, if you were to ask me how I am, I could not honestly tell you I'm any sense of the word good. But maybe that's okay. Maybe that's what you meant to say when you said you do not have to be good. You meant you do not have to be okay. You are allowed to be broken, to pry yourself open, leave niceties unspoken, fail transparently, not simply have to grin and bear it. See, Miss Oliver, I am still trying to figure out what good means. Seriously, thesaurus.com is free. But while Google may come up short, I am finding bits and pieces of your answer in pale cherry blossoms, April snow, and early sun. Miss Oliver, I'm still figuring it out, but your answer, it calls to me, I swear, like wild geese flying high in the clean blue air.
Danica Leong. Judges, let's have those scores in the air in 3, 2, 1. Up high, we have a 7.2, an 8.2, an 8.3, an 8.5, and an 8.8 for Danica. Applaud the poet.
My name is Danica Leong. I go to Lincoln High School. I'm in the class of 22 and I'm a senior. Slam poetry is about creative expression and being able to really connect with the audience. And so being able to be someone a little bit more authentic via performing slam poetry is something I really appreciate about the art form. Coming out of the pandemic, I would say that performing on stage is just a very different mindset. slam poetry tells you basically to be loud, to take up space, to talk to as many people as possible and really communicate in a very expressive way that I feel like the pandemic really just wasn't able to capture. I mean, there's only so much like a 4x6 Zoom screen can really do for you.
After hearing from Donica, I know you're going to want to join us at this year's Verslandia Youth Poetry Slam Championship on Thursday, April 25th, 2024. More information at literary-arts.org. Up next, in our celebration of National Poetry Month, we revisit a conversation from the 2022 Portland Book Festival. Moderated by Oregon Literary Fellowship recipient Genevieve de Guzman, the conversation features Shelley Wong, author of As She Appears, and Tyee Tibble, author of Pocahontas, talking about ancestry, identity, and pop culture references in their work.
So I'll start with you, Shelley. Like, your collection unfolded slowly for me, and that kind of reflects kind of its gestation process, which was a much longer time period. It unfolded slowly for me in a way that actually felt super seductive and erotic even. And it's because the writing contains such bodied natural imagery. I kept thinking like, oh, this is probably like how the ocean will try to seduce me. One reviewer called your poems shape-shifting, which I love. I think of it as soft focus, which feels accurate, but also understates how assured and bold they are as well. And like my question to you is like, what are your speakers trying to hide or reveal in this soft light? Like, why all this mood lighting in your poems?
Yeah, thank you so much. I think the book is dedicated to the Quiet Sisters, and I think in centering a speaker after a relationship that was complicated and at times painful, there is that kind of hesitation to disclose and also to be vulnerable in the world that can feel very estranging when one doesn't see one appear or to find community and sisters. And kind of in that isolation, there is that kind of looking both towards and away and kind of navigating that intimacy, not only with the self, but with the reader. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is kind of a journey of self-love and moving towards self-protection, towards an opening up to the sisters and to love and abundance of the self. Yeah.
Lovely. In contrast, Tyee, your poems felt loud and full of swagger, like firecrackers, I liked it. And it's a reflection really of like the mastery of the craft. There's like a fluidity and fluency that you have with pop culture, but also creation myths and mythology, not just from your own heritage, but like other traditions as well. It kind of all goes in the pot. And I saw that parallel to Shelley's work. It's kind of, it can be kind of seen as a form of shape-shifting. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, thanks for picking up and noticing that. I think that's very true. I think, for a lot of women of colour or who exist in, have to exist in multiple different spaces, it's very natural to kind of shape shift, to have to like tone, is it what you call it here? Tone switching?
Code switching.
Mm-hmm. To be able to code switch and just to be... I think of my book as being like quite hearty indigenous, but it's indigenous with in a modern sense as well, and what it means to be a modern indigenous woman, which means, you know, we have all these other points of references and things that influence me and influence the writing too. Like, you know, I always draw on my ancestors first, I think. My grandparents, my mothers, my whakapapa. That's what we call it in Aotearoa. But there are other things that influence me too, and a lot of it's just like the pop culture and the music and the celebrities that I loved growing up with too. And it's just very natural, and I like having these different kind of pools of references to draw from, because I think it creates like a natural tension or energy on the page when you get to kind of put things up against each other that don't necessarily go together.
Okay, let's move on to origin stories and creation stories. We all have them. But especially for the indigenous person, the immigrant, the minority person in a society, even multiple generations down in America, it's something that gets special reckoning. But the feeling I get is in these collections is that, you know what, sometimes it's got to be more than just bloodlines. Like it kind of goes, there's this yearning to be your own person and being okay with that. So you both of you challenge the fixed state of the self. Maybe can you speak briefly about that idea? You know, is being a woman just being in a constant state of metamorphosis?
I think...
Yeah, like I know, so, Shelly, your family has been here several generations, and I was thinking about your poem, All Beyoncés and Lucy Liu's, and it felt like this identity around ancestry can almost feel like you're herding ghosts and appeasing ghosts, and it almost, like this, it was a litany of pop cultural references, but also it felt like you were trying to assert something about being Asian American in that poem.
Yeah, I think for me, for me, I always feel kind of like on the cusp, so I'm a Leo Virgo cusp, and then I was born in 1980, so I'm on like the Gen X millennial cusp, and then I'm fourth generation Chinese American, and also queer and bi, and so I think that sometimes there are these pressures and sometimes beliefs, you know, or that like, or prejudices against people like not being enough this or that, and that it's not like a binary, but it's or place of lack, but rather like abundance and creation and opportunities. Like, so here I'm writing the poems that I wanted to see in the world because I never, you know, read a book by multi-generational Asian Americans who weren't writing about family or, who weren't like centering joy and artistry and play and sisterhood in a way that felt resonated with my life and what I wanted it to be. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it is that kind of inventing when you're looking for the stories and futures and life that you aspire to build for yourself. So, yeah, I think there is this kind of... feeling of abundance and transforming and possibility. It's kind of like this ongoingness of what could be. Yeah.
Would you like to read that poem for us?
Let's see, the All Beyoncés and this. Yeah, sure. So this is sort of my ode to growing up in Southern California in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. So there's several references across Asian American and Asian pop culture. So the title comes from the Outkast song Hey Ya, which was like 20 years ago. And it's All Beyoncés and Lucy Liu's. Where are you from, the LBC? Can you speak? Hakau Sumai. I am four generations deep in America. Dial up the boba to 75% sweetness, 50% ice. What do your people call juk? Chinese people skip the fourth floor. Don't trust a pho place without a number in its name. Enter June, Lena, Rose, and Waverly. Enter Lucy Liu and my girl Drew. Lucky white ceramic cats collect what's owed. Hello Kitty, little twin stars, my melody. Did you know Keanu Reeves is part Chinese? His Hawaiian name means cool breeze over the mountains. The most exquisite loneliness is Maggie Cheung gliding in a cheongsam as she ascends a staircase. In my domestic dress, I calculate my proportions with finesse, like a G6. Tell me the best midnight restaurant in Chinatown. We run with the yellow Power Ranger. Eat turkey joke after Thanksgiving. Enter Claudia Kishi licking salt off her fingers. Did you watch Keanu and River Phoenix in my own private Idaho? Is my eyeliner even? I can't tell Mandarin from Cantonese. Drink hot water to flush the fat. How did Michelle Kwan change you? Fields of gold forever. Mulan against the world. Are you wearing black tonight? Chibo Motto is playing at the Bronze. Chinese love cash. Little girls dressed in pink and red.
That was poets Shelley Wong and Tai Tibble with moderator Genevieve DeGuzman at Portland Book Festival 2022. Also in 2022, Literary Arts hosted an event with the Alano Club of Portland and their Artists in Recovery series. At that event, poet Hanif Abdurraqib shared work from his then forthcoming, but now in 2024 just published, new book, There's Always This Year. Here's Hanif.
In all of my dreams, the words I love you sound like they are being spoken underwater. The interviewer asks me if I have come to any new conclusions about the people aboard the Titanic who might have survived if they believed the ship was sinking. And I know the easy answer is about the courting of death by those who consider themselves invincible, but I ask, who is in charge of setting the distance between knowing you will die and not wanting to? I say, I didn't learn to swim because I was told we would never touch the water. From up close, the severing of a metal vessel can sound like anything, a moan twirling into an ear, or the relieved gasps that arrive after a season of sobbing, when the breath calms itself and begins to float lazily along some endless and hazy blue, not unlike the blue that a child points towards at the sand-struck edge of the world from far enough out. It is impossible to tell where the sky ends and the water begins, the child might say. What strange architecture, the illusion between heavens. I ask if the interviewer knows about false horizons. The abnormal refraction of light creates two layers. What the eye sees is a lie, and beneath it is a reality. And in the middle appears to be nothing, a blur of darkness where your executioner rests. It would not serve me to know how I will die, but I would not mind knowing when my heart will break next. And what will usher in its breaking, and who might be an audience to a small nation of shattering, a nation of splintered reflections into each other like unkept vines weeping and winding a cure for their own lonely ache. There is a breath blown out in the moment between dawn and the fluorescence of daylight, thin as the thread that sometimes barricades the door between love and anguish. The interviewer tells me, we've talked about false horizons already. What the eye can be tricked into seeing. The interviewer asks if I'm saying that no one believed the iceberg was real, but I don't understand science as much as I understand resurrection or longing. When I throw my arm over to the empty side of my bed, I apologize to the absence. Believe in the illusion until it begins to speak back. I know we are here to talk about drowning, but what if we never find each other in the afterlife? If we arrive with a memory of love, a sweetness that took its leave upon our earthly exit. What if in heaven we are meant to wander, lonely as an iceberg, floating between a lie and the truth? Wouldn't you want to stay a little longer? The child standing on the shore understands this means to say there is no difference between the suffering. Heaven is another kind of drowning. The interviewer asks if I know that the flowers I've been holding are dead. When I look down, I wake up. A parade of rose petals spiral from under my tongue, each one covered in ice. I'm gonna read a few things from my new book, There's Always This Year. I don't even know how to word what this book is about, but I think it is safe to say it is comfortably about Ohio and about, in my mind, I think it is most about surviving beyond a place where you believed you would survive. Is anyone here from Cleveland? No. Okay, so this doesn't matter. You don't really need to know this, but there was this story I found. In every book I write, I feel like there's something I find in the research that just like captivates me to no end. And in 1976, in Cleveland, just like cars were blowing up everywhere, like all over the city because of this mob war that went on. And it coincided with the Cavs being good for the first time. And so this thing had happened where people were like leaving the arenas afraid to go to their cars, and like that kind of fucked me up, this idea of like this city wrecked by bombs at a really celebratory time. So I'm gonna read a little bit about bombs. In 1976, 36 bombs went off in Cleveland. The news dubbed it Bomb City, USA. Bombing itself wasn't new. The car bomb had long been one of the methods used to dispose of enemies. It left no evidence, but it was also loud, drew attention, and wasn't especially easy to execute. Pulling a trigger or even drawing a knife across the throat took less work, but also didn't always send a message. And in Cleveland, in 1976, power would be achieved by the sending of messages. So the city was alight with bombs through the summer and into the fall. Cars being transformed into hills of jagged and glowing metal, whatever bodies were inside of them sometimes rendered unrecognizable depending on the immediacy of the explosion. All of this would happen out in the open, in broad daylight. The mob was becoming populated with younger, more reckless enforcers. When a city is rattled by explosions in an infinity cycle of retaliation so vicious it can hardly be remembered what its starting point or end goal is, even those who aren't targets become targets. A person walking next to a car that goes up in flames could become collateral if the explosion does enough damage. Fear screams through a city and rearranges its DNA, no matter how the scent of promise and jubilation spun through the air before it was torn by fear's screaming. The bomb relies on the trick we have turned over in our palms here many times already. The bomb relies on the fact that the person cannot see it coming, at least not the person who might most want to see it coming, the person with their name scrawled into the afterlife of its detonation. Even if you know yourself to be a target, even if you have stitched the kind of awareness into your mind that comes with living through a city torn apart by explosions, you will never know exactly when the flash of hot light will come for you. And I can only imagine, if I were not me and someone in this position in a city alight, at first I would maybe frantically check my car or underneath my porch in the mornings, and then I would have to give in to the fact that what was out to get me might just eventually catch my understanding what could come for you and being able to see it coming are two separate parts of the same machine, but I know what would allow me to put a key into an ignition without closing my eyes and holding my breath. I know what would allow me to sleep easy, or at least easy enough, what with sleep being the relative that shepherds us towards some eternal forest garlanded with shadows. And I would like to pause here briefly to consider devotion. The kind of devotion it might take, for example, to extend your open palm so that someone you love or are otherwise beholden to might drop their car keys into your hand. The kind of devotion it might take, for example, to start a car that is not your car in a time and place where the car itself was a weapon and therefore the key nudged into the ignition was an extension of that weapon. What it might take for you to drive around a block a couple times, knowing that someone, somewhere, not far from where your palms sweat against the steering wheel's leather, might be holding a small device with a single red button. And I know this isn't entirely romantic. I know that fear can also be one of devotion's many mothers, but maybe someone you have grown to love is more afraid than you are. And maybe you take their keys from them, pull them out of a hand without mentioning the hands shaking. I would like to consider the ways we all march to our sometimes boring deaths without understanding what it is to be so devoted to someone or something that you might be compelled to speed up that march so that they can continue their own. And I am not here to consider what is good or what is bad, but simply to consider what is sometimes necessary, even if I don't have the heart for it. I only have the heart for far inferior devotions. So does everyone I love. There maybe just aren't enough people who want us dead.
That was Hanif of Durraqib at an Alano Club event in 2022. Continuing our celebration of National Poetry Month, up next, we have Lee Young Lee at Portland Arts and Lectures in 2008, who shares his poem, Virtues of the Boring Husband.
Boy, you know, poets are so treacherous. This whole poem said I would never tell, and here I am reading about it to a whole room. Actually, I was going to read one more poem, but I'm looking at this clock, and I think we only have 15 minutes left to take questions. I'll read one more. Oh, thank you. Oh, thanks. Thank you. This is called Virtues of the Boring Husband. This is a completely autobiographical self-portrait. Thank you very much for your generous attention. Virtues of the Boring Husband. Whenever I talk, my wife falls asleep. This is true. This is just straight autobiography. So now, when she can't sleep, I talk. It's like magic. Say she hasn't had a good night's sleep in a week, feels exhausted, and lies down early in the evening, but begins to toss and turn. I just lie down beside her, prop my head up in one hand and say, you know, I've been thinking. Immediately, she calms down, finds a fetal posture, and tucks her head under my arm. I know she lies dispersed, though in one body, claimed by rabble cares and the need to sleep. Will you stay? She asks. I'm right here, I answer. Now what were you saying? She wonders. And so I talk. It isn't that lovers always meet in a garden. And already her eyes get that dizzy look, like she can't focus. Go ahead, I tell her. Close your eyes. Okay, she says, but you keep talking. And so I do. It isn't that lovers always speak together in a house by the sea, or in a room with shadows of leaves and branches on the walls and ceiling. It's that such spaces emerge out of the listening, they're speaking to each other and genders. I mean, maybe, and she sighs. Her breathing begins to slow. And I remember something I heard somewhere. Every so many breaths, a sigh. Every so many sighs, sleep. Or was it every so many sighs, death? I go on talking, now stroking her head, pushing her hair back from her forehead, clearing her bright brow, and listening for her next sigh. Maybe the face-to-face, true lovers in act, manifests a prior coincidence of heaven and earth, say, or body and soul, equal opposites exchanging and combining properties in perpetual transformation. Shore and not shore, sea and sky, room and a world, the gazer and the gazed upon. Little twitches run the length of her, beginning with her arms, then her legs, then her feet, as though tensions were being fired from her body. She mumbles the beginning of a word. I go on talking. Maybe the union of lovers is an instance of a primary simultaneity, timeless, from which arises the various shapes of time and duration, arrival, departure, waiting, resuming, fountain, terrace, path, and eve. And maybe any world is born, is offspring of the liaison between God and mind, mind and mind's source. I count her second sigh, lower, longer. Or maybe God says, I love you, and the whole universe, consciousness included, is a shape of that pronouncement. Or maybe there's no you in that, but only I love, ringing, engendering all of space, every quadrant, an expression of God's first nature, I love. Or maybe a you arises as echo, the counter-ringing to the sovereign I love. And we're the you to the source's I, the second person to God's first personhood. Then, to surrender any sense of an I is to feel our true condition, a you before God, and to be seen. Being seen, the crowning experience and mystery of a you. Maybe too often we mistake the guest for the host, confusing the I and the you, and yet, maybe, out of that confusion, more worlds arise. By now, she's barely listening, if at all. I lower my voice and go on rambling, afraid she'll wake if I stop too soon. Maybe love for God amounts to the beloved returning the lover's gaze. And out of that look and looking back, that linking look, all of our notions of space, home, distance, beginning, end, recurrence, death, debt, fruition, number, weight, emerge. All are issue of that meeting between lover and lover, our soul's intercourse with what it loves. By now, her jaw has gone slack, her fingers loose, where earlier they were clenching the edge of the blanket, and I'm almost whispering. Maybe it's true what sages have said. I don't know if I'm remembering it right. Something about moving up a ladder of love. Maybe we learn to love a person, say, first as object, and then as presence, and then as essence, and then as disclosure of the divine. Or maybe all at the same time, or discovering over time each deeper aspect to be true. And maybe our seeing it in another proves that face inside ourselves. Oh, I don't know. You sleep now. And then I stop talking, kiss her forehead, and wait a minute before leaving the bed and closing the door behind me.
As we heard in Lee Young Lee's poem, poetry isn't about having the answers, but helping us ask some of the questions. To conclude this National Poetry Month celebration, we're going back to where we started the hour with Ada Limon at Portland Arts and Lectures in April 2023.
Right now, as I finish this talk, I am thinking of how I never have any answers, never have any wisdom to offer. But then I think, that's okay. I distrust the person that claims to know everything. And that's why I trust poems. They make room for our uncertainty and clarity in equal measures. So yes, I can talk about poetry and its power until I turn blue and all the line breaks run home and turn into sentences again. But it's not just about poetry. It's about finding the way to talk about this moment in time, this square of earth that we are standing on, the little arrow that says, you are here, and really being here. I think there's power in that. Emily Dickinson once wrote, not knowing when the dawn will come, I open every door. Poetry allows us to open those doors. And not just tell us who we are, but where we are on this planet and in this time. If, as scientist Kate Marvel wrote, we are improbable life on a perfect planet, then isn't it our job to notice every part of this so that we might find language for this complicated love, that we have for this world, that language for a complicated love, that language is poetry. Dead stars. Out here, there's a bowing, even the trees are doing. Winter's icy hand at the back of all of us, black bark, slick yellow leaves, a kind of stillness that feels so mute it's almost in another year. I am a hearth of spiders these days, a nest of trying. We point out the stars that make Orion as we take out the trash, the rolling containers, a song of suburban thunder. It's almost romantic as we adjust the waxy blue recycling bin until you say, man, we should really learn some new constellations. And it's true. We keep forgetting about Antlia, Centaurus, Draco, Lacerta, Hydra, Lyra, and Lynx. But mostly we're forgetting we're dead stars too. My mouth is full of dust and I wish to reclaim the rising, to lean in the spotlight of streetlight with you, toward what's larger within us, toward how we were born. Look, we are not unspectacular things. We've come this far, survived this much. What would happen if we decided to survive more, to love harder? What if we stood up with our synapses and flesh and said no, no to the rising tides, stood for the many mute mouths of the sea, of the land? What would happen if we used our bodies to bargain for the safety of others, for Earth, if we declared it a clean night, if we stopped being terrified, if we launched our demands into the sky, made ourselves so big people could point to us with the arrows they make in their minds, rolling their trash bins out after all of this is over?
That was U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limone at Portland Arts and Lectures in April 2023. Her signature project as Poet Laureate, an anthology she edited titled You Are Here, Poetry in the Natural World, was published just this week. This episode was a celebration of National Poetry Month. We also heard from Lee Young Lee reading his poem Virtues of the Boring Husband, from Hanif Abdurraqib at an Alano Club event at Literary Arts, and from Tai Tibble, Shelley Wong, and Genevieve Hudson at the 2022 Portland Book Festival. We heard 2022 Verslandia poet Donica Leung, and we listened to Seamus Heaney share one of his poems at Portland Arts and Lectures in 2002. You can hear the full versions of these conversations and readings on this very program, The Archive Project. Visit literary-arts.org to search past episodes and have your best National Poetry Month ever. This has been Literary Arts, The Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. The Archive Project is produced in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our executive producer is Andrew Proctor. The show is produced by Matthew Workman for radio and podcast, with oversight by Amanda Bullock and Crystal Liguori. A special thanks to Liz Olofsson, who constructed this episode. Our intern is Ada Hallstrom. Special thanks to Literary Arts marketing staff Jyoti Roy, Hope Levy, and Laura Rankins, and to the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thank you also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thank you for listening. I'm Amanda Bullock, and this has been another episode of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.